Thank you very much to the organizers of the whole meeting. This has been a tremendous venue. It's a terrific meeting, and thank you to Dr. Hertz-Pichotto for organizing this symposium and inviting me. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about some work we've been doing on perinatal exposure to air pollution and autism in the Nurses' Health Study at Harvard. But before I launch into my results, I wanted to step back a little bit and give you a little bit of background or history, albeit brief and in somewhat broad strokes, of sort of environmental studies of environmental factors into autism, particularly toxicant factors, and sort of how we got to where we are now. So early on, and as Dr. Cho was saying, this hasn't been that long, early studies that tried to look into this association between environmental factors, in particular toxicants, and even more specifically usually metals, and the risk of autism certainly had many suggestive findings of differences between children with autism and children without autism in body burden levels of different metals, looking in different tissues like urine or hair or teeth. But they almost uniformly had several methodological issues that really sort of limited the strength of conclusions that we could draw from those studies. And those limitations centered largely around several aspects, one being that they were almost all fairly small, and a second being that they had either unclear or even somewhat questionable recruitment processes for their cases and controls, and that those things combined can make it difficult. You know, you may not be comparing apples and apples, and you're comparing apples and oranges, and you can get different stories. They also suffered from a major problem, which is one of potential reverse causality. And what I mean by that is that as small case control studies, you go about this by recruiting children who have autism and then children who don't, but you're collecting these samples from them at that time. So the children already have the autism. So while one of the reasons a metal level could be different in a child with autism is that that metal exposure predisposed to developing autism, but the other reason, of course, could be that some biology of the disease or a change in behavior, which we know occurs with autism, affected your exposure to these things, and that's why your level's different. And in fact, those early studies, while showing often many differences, had at times conflicting results. So subsequent studies have clearly advanced beyond that, and methodologically they are far stronger. They are often several have come along, and they're one much larger with much more rigorous and well-documented recruitment processes for cases and controls, which allows you to draw stronger inferences from them. Some examples of the CHARGE study, which you'll hear more about today. The SEED is another study. But as case control studies, there's still this concern, especially when looking for toxicants within biosamples, that if you're collecting them from a child when they're recruited into your study already having autism, you may be subject to this reverse causality problem. So several studies recently have been trying to get around this problem of reverse causality by effectively trying to separate out the exposure assessment or estimation process from the individual mother or child process. And what I mean by that basically is finding ways to estimate what we think people are exposed to that are not in any way affected by the child or the mother. And people have taken different approaches to this with different types of toxicants. I'm going to focus on air pollution for this talk. But some of the ways people have done this is, at least in the U.S., to take advantage of some databases collected for other reasons. So the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency monitors large releases of toxicants from different industrial point sources, and this is a database that is countrywide and that they maintain. So some people have looked at a county level, releases of, say, mercury from industry and how that relates to county-level autism rates. Those studies, unfortunately, used school records to determine autism rates, which is somewhat problematic, but at least on the exposure side, they were removing this reverse causality issue. Other studies have used proxies for exposure, such as maternal residents from freeways or roads, as a proxy for traffic-related pollution. Others have taken advantage of monitoring systems set up around different local regions and more widely that monitor specific aspects of air pollution and use those to estimate exposure levels at a maternal residence. And a couple studies have also used another database that is produced by the Environmental Protection Agency in the U.S. called the Hazardous Air Pollutant Models. And this is a set of models that take account of a whole inventory of different emitters of different toxicants and couples that with known physics of dispersion and things of that sort to basically model what the level of any given pollutant in their model would be at any place in the U.S. at the census tract level. The first one of those was done in the Bay Area in San Francisco by Gail Windham et al., and a second one was subsequently done in the North Carolina, West Virginia region by Amy Kalkbrenner. And it's, in fact, those studies that what I'll talk to you about, what I've been building on. So all of these studies together are starting to coalesce. Let me go back to that first slide. All of these, to some degree, are starting to coalesce around a story and finding associations of different sorts, but, you know, around some kind of coherent picture of some relation between air pollution and autism. Given that, though, there still, of course, are some issues that one has to consider, even though these studies are leaps and bounds beyond the earlier ones in terms of methodological rigor, we do have issues such as they are almost all in relatively restricted geographic areas, so that can have effects on the distribution of your exposures. There are some issues with case identification, pulling either from administrative records or public surveillance systems. And then as case control studies, a lot of them, you know, you still have to worry a little bit about your controls. Who are they? Where are they coming from? Are they biased in terms of who decides to participate in any way? And particularly with relation to these HAP models, the hazardous air pollutant models, they actually model almost 200 different toxicants. So that's a lot of data to try and work through, and, you know, many signals may just be popping up, and that can be problematic. So this is where I came to this field to see if there were things we could add and address in the context of this. And so what we really set out to do was to look at this air pollution autism association, but try and do it in a cohort we have that is at a national level, at very large. And also as a cohort, it's well defined. We know everybody who's in it. And to deal with this problem of the multiple pollutant issues and many things we're trying to look at, we decided to start by just focusing on a few pollutants that the prior papers had suggested might be associated with autism. So to do that, we took advantage of a cohort we have at Harvard called the Nurses' Health Study 2. It was started in 1989 when over 100,000 female nurses were recruited at the time between the ages of 25 and 42. At that point when they were recruited, they were in 14 of the U.S. states, but by now they've dispersed across the entire United States. And what is done, this wasn't set up for autism, it was set up to study health effects and health issues in the nurses, and every 2 years they're sent questionnaires and they respond to these extensive questionnaires about all sorts of factors going on in their lives. And in 2005, we introduced a question to the nurses about whether they had any children with an autism spectrum disorder, and specifically autism, Asperger's, or some other autism spectrum disorder. And 839 of these nurses reported having at least one child with an ASD. So in terms of the study that I'll be presenting to you with the air pollution data, our final N for the number of cases that we could look at was 325, and that was partly because we had to do a follow-up survey of these women to sort of get more details about the autism, and because of nurses' health protocol, you're only allowed to contact women who responded to the last questionnaire. So of the 839, 756 had responded to the 2007 questionnaire that we could follow up with. But of those, we got responses from 636, or 84%. And after excluding children with autism who clearly had some other condition like trisomy 18 or any of the ones listed here, and also restricting to the years of 1987 through 2002 so that we could have reliable address data for these women, we had 329 kids, four of whom we couldn't geocode sufficiently to use in our analyses. So obviously the case ascertainment in this process was just by maternal report. Now, you have to keep in mind that these are all nurses, so they have a certain level of health understanding that's not typical of a general population. But nonetheless, we did a small validation study where we randomly selected 50 of these nurses and recontacted them to do a telephone administration of the ADIR and got very, very good validation results with that. 43 of them, or 86%, fully met ADR criteria for autism spectrum. Another 10% basically missed it by one point in one domain. And then the other two, while missing by a little bit more, clearly were affected more than a typically developing child. So we were very happy about that validation process. Of course, a big advantage of working within the Nurses' Health Study is that we know the population, the entire population from which our cases came from. So controls is not an issue here. We just take everybody else. So the controls in our study were all the women who in 2005 reported not having a child with an autism spectrum disorder. We had to subset that actually to those who responded to a supplemental 2001 questionnaire because, as I say, the Nurses' Health Study is directed at the nurses, not the kids, so we needed some additional information from that study on the year of birth of the children. And then because any mother could have more than one child, we had so many of them, we just randomly selected one child who was born within the appropriate years of our cases to be a control. That gave us almost 26,000 children, about 4,000 of whom we weren't able to geocode sufficiently, leaving us with just over 22,000 controls. So for the exposure assessment in this, we used that HAP model that I talked about that was used in the Bay Area study and the North Carolina, West Virginia study. It's not just one model, so they haven't done it in every year, but they've done four of them. So it's 1990, 1996, 1999, and 2002. So we had to essentially assign the levels predicted by one of those models to the year of the child. So we basically picked the model that was closest to the birth year of the child. So indicated in the blue there. So the kids from 87 to 1994 were, if they were born in those years, they were assigned whatever the level of the 1990 model. For our statistical analysis, as I said, we focused on 14 of these pollutants that there had been sort of some suggestion from the earlier papers of an association with autism. We did typical logistic regression for this. We just turned any individual pollutant exposure level into quintiles and modeled it that way. Because many of these actually were metals, we also did a sort of combined metals score by pooling the odds ratios for the different metals using a random effects sort of meta-analytic approach, and considered trends across levels of the different pollutants by creating a continuous variable that is done by assigning the median to each woman, the median of her whatever the quintile that she falls in. And, of course, we have lots of data in the Nurses' Health Study to use to adjust for potential confounders. In addition, we also pulled in information at the census tract level from the U.S. Census Bureau. So we could adjust for factors like the median income in the census tract of the mother, the percent of those with a college education in that tract, as well as personal information like the education of the nurse's parents, the year of birth of the child, the maternal age at the birth, and the specific HAP model year. And some of those first few there, the idea was to try and get at issues around case ascertainment, whether depending on sort of the socioeconomic status of where the mother was, there may be more or less awareness of autism and the likelihood of getting diagnosed. So quickly cutting to the chase, basically, and I'm going to show the main findings here. And what I've done sort of for comparison is to put up also the results from the earlier Bay Area study by Gail Windham et al. And then the Kalkbrenner study in North Carolina and West Virginia. I will say first that this isn't an exact comparison because the approach is slightly different. In our data, we were comparing the top quintile to the bottom quintile. In the Windham paper, it was the top quartile to the bottom half. And in the Kalkbrenner paper, she basically treated it as a linear thing and looked at a change that was the change from a 20 to 80 percentile range in their data. And I've also indicated with an asterisk here the pollutants that actually showed a significant linear trend when modeled across the dose response curve. And there's a few things to pull out of this. I mean, the first thing is that quite obviously, if you can see from our data, we're seeing some reasonably strong associations between the level of these different pollutants in the mother's census tract at the time of birth of the child and the risk of that child then being diagnosed with autism. And the second thing is the rather, to my mind, striking similarity between the results we found in this nationwide group and the results from that original Bay Area study. Not quite as comparable with the North Carolina study, but that was actually statistically handled a little bit differently, so there are reasons why that might be the case. This is the first set of the 14 pollutants that we looked at. You can see among these, the highest effect was for mercury with a doubling of the odds ratio. I should point out, too, this is air levels of all of these things. And then the pooled metals was sort of the most robust and consistent of these. In the other set, this is the other set of pollutants that we looked at. Again, good correlation with the earlier studies. Diesel particulate matter, in particular, showed pretty strong association with also a doubling of the odds ratio. And both that and methylene chloride also had significant trends. So we, you know, even though we took this approach of focusing on these metals that had some suggestion from prior literature as a way of kind of not doing all sorts of comparisons to find what might be there, there's still the lingering concern that somehow we have, you know, by good fortune for our senses, happened to pick a few that showed good results and, you know, all of the others didn't, that, you know, we got lucky and picked out a few that happened to be high out of a whole schmear of nothing, basically. So to try and get at whether that was occurring, I'm showing the next plot, which is not a typical one that you would see, but what I'm showing here is every pollutant that's in those EPA models at some point. And the black diamonds are the a priori nonmetals we focused on, and the red squares are the a priori metals. And then the gray diamonds are everything else. And what's shown here is the odds ratio for the fifth quintile versus the first of any of these pollutants plotted against the p-value of that odds ratio for the quintile. And the p-value gets smaller as you go out the x-axis. And the point of doing this really is just to get a general sense of whether we're really looking at noise. If this was just noise and this was random scatter, what we would sort of expect is a kind of even distribution stemming, you know, sort of falling on either side of an odds ratio of 1 and kind of getting wider as you move down to lower p-values. And to some extent, that's what we see when you're at p-values above 0.05. You kind of see a kind of distribution that looks relatively symmetrical around an odds ratio of 1. But when we get down to the lower p-values, there's clearly this tail of pollutants that is up in the increased risk of autism range that isn't balanced by something on the other side, as we might expect if this was just random. So there seems to be some signal going on down there. And I will say that in focusing on a priori metals, 6 out of the 14 fell below 0.05 in this approach, whereas 18 out of 168 of the others did. That means the a prioris were about 4 times more likely to appear significant. So they seem to, whatever signal is there, is indeed centering around these a prioris we were looking at. A few other analyses that we did, I'm not showing you, we stratified by sex. We had, of course, many more boys in this with autism in our group. Out of the 325, only 46 were girls. But when we did stratify, these results were clearly much more robust for the boys. It's hard to tell whether how much of that is just due to the fact that we didn't have very many girls, but really the signals looked very weak among the girls. The only one for which maybe there was some signal there, including a sort of moderately monotonic trend upwards with increased exposure, was actually diesel particulate matter, which I think is interesting. And if you actually did a formal statistical test on the pooled metals summary score, that was very highly significant in terms of the interaction with sex. We also obviously had a lot of things we were comparing, so we also did a false discovery rate approach to sort of adjust for multiple tests, and essentially the results looked the same when we did that approach. And we did several sensitivity analyses. We looked just at the pooled metals result for simplicity, but the results looked, if anything, slightly stronger when we restricted the analysis to the 6 most populous states in our group. And relatively similar results when we further adjusted for family income, partner's education, or smoking during pregnancy. And also, because the HAP models are actually slightly different from year to year, we were worried that maybe that was introducing something. But when we restricted the analysis to only one HAP year, either 1990 or 96, because that's where the majority of our data was, you got basically the same pattern of results. We did another analysis where we also adjusted for population density, and in that one, the odds ratios were slightly reduced. Of course, what we'd like to know is that if there really is something going on with these pollutants, can we identify whether there is one or some set of them that's really driving the results? And we did a few things to try and get at that. You can't, in typical statistical approaches, throw all of these things into a model at the same time. It's statistically untractable. But so we picked our sort of top hits, not including diesel, because unfortunately diesel was actually only modeled in one year in a subset, so it's a much smaller amount of data for the diesel. But a model that included lead, manganese, mercury, and nickel All of the odds ratios were somewhat reduced. For what it's worth, mercury and methylene chloride was in the model as well, seemed to be the strongest of those. We also took a sort of novel approach that it has come out of the machine learning literature of paradigms for picking out the most important predictors within a very highly dimensional data set. It's called conditional random forest. I won't go into the details, but one of the things that it does allow you to do is actually put a lot more things in the model to begin with, so we could put all of our a priori's in. And for what it's worth, that one picked out styrene as appearing to be the most predictive of autism. So our study, of course, still has limitations we have to consider. There's clearly a lot of exposure misclassification in what we're doing. These are modeled levels of pollutants. They're not actual measurements. They are modeled outdoor levels. We don't spend all our time outdoors. And they're not individual level. They're at the census tract. And, of course, there are some issues with nurses' address and the timing of the pregnancy versus when we're assigning the HAP model to that. We also, of course, only ascertained the autism cases by maternal report, but the validation appeared very, very good. And definitely keep in mind, these are all nurses, so they have a much higher level than the general population of medical understanding and presumably access to medical care. I would guess all of those things would tend to bias towards the null rather than create a spurious association. We, of course, can't rule out residual confounding, but at least it wouldn't be something very locally confounding. It would have to be something on a more national scale. So in summary of that, clearly our results seem to strengthen this association, and there's really a literature now beginning to coalesce around aspects of air pollution that are related to autism. We were able to do it on a national scale. One of the things that gave us was a much higher levels of exposure and a wider distribution, which helps. And of course, we had these controls. We didn't have to worry about where we were going to get them from. We knew the entire population. And so overall, these a priori pollutants that had popped up before do seem to be more important, but it is very hard to try and identify one or a set. And we have this evidence for a potential sex-specific association. So just to end and leave you with some thoughts, I mean, the good news is really that the sort of methodological rigor of these studies of environmental exposures and autism are advancing dramatically. We've come way beyond the initial studies, and that can only help speed up our understanding of risk factors for autism. And the data beginning to coalesce around air pollutants, of course, we have more to do. We need to get more refined models and look more carefully at getting much more specific estimates of these exposures. But there is something that seems to be getting stronger here, which raises exciting possibilities of both public and potentially private interventions to reduce exposures and thereby reduce the burden of autism. But we clearly have the next level to go to, and that's doing things like individual measurements on the mothers and the children during pregnancy or even prior to pregnancy to, you know, completely get away from this reverse causation issue with very specific measurements at an individual level. And several studies are beginning to try and do this. Some are focusing on high-risk groups for autism, like siblings of pregnancies of mothers who already have a child with autism, like the Marble study in early. And others are trying to take advantage of banked samples to be able to go back and look at things before, like the EMA study. And hopefully this will not only help us identify more precisely what the critical components are that increases risk so we can try and intervene, but also perhaps give us a better understanding of the mechanisms of how these things are doing this to potentially find other ways to intervene. This, as we heard this morning, and as I think a lot of people are certainly aware of, this almost certainly is going to involve interactions between the environment and the genome, whether that be the genome itself or epigenetic marks on that. I think both are going to be important. So with that, I just wanted to thank my collaborators. This was funded by the Department of Defense, and most importantly, Andrea Roberts, a postdoc who did all these analyses, and Kristen Lyle, who was instrumental in getting the whole autism project underway, and the nurses, and my co-PIs on the grant, Alberto Ascario and Susan Santangelo. Thank you.